All right. Hello and welcome, everyone, to this week's bonus episode of the Entry Level Left. My name is Jared.
I'm Matt.
I'm Nathan.
And we felt the need to diversify our podcasting base today. So we brought on another white Bernard brother, Ian Henson. Ian is joining us. How are you, Ian?
What's up, guys? I'm good. How are you guys?
Awesome.
So for our listeners, Ian, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got involved with left politics? What's the skinny?
Yeah, totally. So, I grew up in Tampa, Florida. I got involved in leftist politics in around like 2016. I was like flirting with socialist-y kind of stuff just from finding like a random Richard Wolf video on Reddit. And then started calling myself a socialist. But I didn't really start getting involved until the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016. At that point, I got kind of bummed out that he was just kind of getting crushed by the Dems, the Dem establishment. And so I joined the tiny, like, four-person sect of Socialist Alternative for, like, a little while and read, like, a bunch of Trotskyist stuff. And then I eventually just left there because it just didn't really exist. And then I joined a little group called the Communist League of Tampa. With this kind of Kotskyist left comm kind of stuff. They had their hands in the Tampa IWW chapter, and then this really cool thing called the Solidarity Network in Tampa, which was kind of my introduction to actual on-the-ground stuff. We did, like, tenant kind of organizing and, you know, if just, like, little petty kind of wage theft stuff from, like, local bosses. And we actually won a couple campaigns in that area. We just it just got overpowered. We just didn't have enough people.
Yeah.
And by the time I was moving to the West Coast, they started doing sex work, like organizing sex workers and stuff, which was really cool. And then out here, I joined the DSA in LA and did some stuff for the Housing and Homelessness Committee. And again, just like tenants organizing. So I guess most of my experience ended up being in trying to organize tenants and, you know, help them if they're being exploited by their landlords.
Right. Which is big, like, especially with what we're going through right now with Corona, which we'll get into later. Definitely, definitely happy to have you on the pod. We're all online friends. We've known each other for quite a while, so we're happy to have Ian on finally. So we wanted to talk about a little bit about where Bernie's campaign stands. I know, especially for myself, after Super Tuesday, you know, I've seen people kind of get demoralized, kind of lose focus on what's going on. And I think it's pertinent that we reset and sort of focus back on where we actually stand. So in terms of Bernie's campaign, which a lot of people are already familiar, but he's transitioned pretty much to kind of like a benefit program for Corona relief. But there's still quite a lot of primary states coming up. In April this month, on the 7th, we have Wisconsin. We have Alaska on the 10th, Wyoming on the 18th, Puerto Rico on the 26th, Ohio on the 28th, so on and so forth. So there are quite a lot of delegates up for grabs still. Although, you know, I'm not sure how y'all feel about Bernie, where we're at with that. I know a lot of people are kind of just moving towards like a defeatist sort of stance, but what do y'all think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say like I don't have particularly a defeatist stance, but I mean, I think the chances are pretty grim. I think that his ability to actually win at this point, I don't think is there. I think, you know, what this campaign has showed is that If we didn't learn the lesson in 2016, I think people have certainly learned it this time around. And that's that the DNC, the leadership of the Democratic Party, is just fundamentally categorically opposed to any of what Bernie is proposing and have since built their entire arsenal around now Joe Biden. And because of that, I think, you know, they're going to get their asses handed to them in November, especially because people like me, like, I'm not voting. Bernie was the last Democrat I will ever cast my vote for, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with Jared. I would also say like that I think the Democrats are perfectly fine with losing. I think that, you know, what they do, what they feel like they do best at, I think, is just playing opposition party to the Republicans. I think that if, you know, if it comes down to either winning power with Bernie Sanders or staying out of power with Joe Biden, they would honestly probably prefer to stay out of power with Joe Biden because, you know, I think the Trump campaign in a way has been a gift to them, you know, because it allows them to kind of have the stage as the morally, you know,
righteous,
morally righteous party in the U.S., the party of decorum, the party of respectability, and also not have to be the party that dishes out austerity for the working class, which is exactly what they would do if they took power and exactly what they have done every time they have taken power. So, you know, I don't actually think that they care about winning anymore. It's more just about maintaining some semblance of status quo while sort of looking like they're trying.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. And like we've talked about on previous episodes, for listeners that may be new, definitely check out our episode on like liberalism versus the left. Check out our episodes on like social justice warrior culture, things like that. But liberals, they really don't care to win, especially like establishment Democrats. And really for like a uninitiated listener to this podcast, what you really have to understand is that, you know, the power structures of the Democratic Party are highly like corporate. They're very much tied to like business class, Silicon Valley. And these people don't really lose out on their privileges under Trump versus Biden. You know what I mean? Like these people are not going to lose any type of privilege in society or power in society with a Biden versus Trump. They're only going to lose some type of power. And then the working class gains some type of a power under Bernie. So that's like why that they structurally don't want, you know, Bernie to win because he's a threat. Whereas Joe Biden, he's been on record saying to healthcare companies or insurance companies that, you know, don't worry about Medicare for all. Or that's another thing that like Pelosi and the establishment Democrats push like to their donors, like, don't worry about Medicare for all passing. It's not going to pass. And I think what liberals need to really wake up and understand at this point is that you need to look at the class analysis. Like Joe Biden is not in the same class as you and your family. Like these people don't have fundamentally different interests, agendas, and narratives that they're operating under. And it's clear that when it comes to Trump versus Biden, there's really no policy differences between them.
Well, I think that's the thing, too, is we don't even know really what are Joe Biden's policies. And I think that on top of that, kind of going to what Ian was talking about with them losing and your kind of points about class, you know, the class analysis that needs to be there is the reality is while it doesn't really necessarily, you know, a high figure Democrat, whether they are from the same class as someone, the reality is the donor base of the Democratic Party is not. And yeah. Trump has been a great fundraising opportunity for the Democratic Party because their base does want to win. And a lot of their base does comprise of like wealthy coastal elite libs, you know, who as soon as Orange Man Bad does something or they, you know, watch the latest episode of Rachel Maddow, they're just slamming the donate button to the DNC with the hopes that they'll, you know, they'll take down Trump. You know, it's kind of their mantra has been anyone but Trump. And unfortunately, anyone but Trump it's not a political strategy that has any teeth. And it's certainly not going to win in November when you have so many people who are under such extreme economic hardship that they're looking for a genuine alternative to the system. And the Democratic line is basically, let's go back to the Obama years, which was the highest stage of neoliberalism.
It's so funny because like, if you even talk to sort of like mainstream, you know, neo-lib, like just people like, you know, that aren't a part of the actual Democratic Party apparatus, they don't really have a coherent political program either. For them, I mean, really what they just want so bad, their dream scenario is just a fucking episode of West Wing, you know, and it's just It's like there is no political coherency anywhere on the current U.S. Liberal wing. Like, it just doesn't exist. If you ask them what they want, they really couldn't even tell you. All they want is to have, you know, decorum and respectability back. It's just, for them, everything is aesthetics. Their whole political ideology is boiled down to just like order and aesthetics. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I think we've talked about that even on previous episodes. It's like, if your class, you know, interests aren't at stake, then what do you have to care about other than aesthetics? You know what I mean? Like, it's not affecting your material means to reproduce yourself. So obviously the only thing you're going to care about is, you know, oh, these people are being so mean to me on the internet, as opposed to asking like, why are they so fucking mad at me? You know, for keeping this sort of narrative going. And I mean, the media class especially has been unified behind the Democratic Party, both right and left. You know, the shift of these people who were rolling out the red carpet for the war in Iraq, who are supposedly these never Trumpers, are fully in bed with this machine to take down Bernie Sanders, and are just playing this horseshoe theory game of, well, they're exactly the same. They're both angry white men screaming at me about something, and I don't like that. It's threatening. So fuck both of them. They're the same.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot going on with everything. And then, and another thing that really like set me off is kind of like tangential, but the Elizabeth Warren scenario, and how there are people out there that literally still think that she is some type of a progressive, when, I mean, in my opinion, if she was really a progressive, it would be, you know, unequivocal. Like, she would just support Bernie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's this sort of this professional managerial class type people, or PMC type people, who are Warren supporters, and they're very especially like identity politic addled in terms of like their outlook on politics. They don't understand that justice has to come from a material basis. They think that justice is just this superficial, this thing that Ian was talking about, this aesthetic type of justice that is sort of like the trademark of neoliberalism and liberalism in terms of culture, is this idea where we can have justice based on identity alone without any material or structural change. But that's just not how the levers of power or society has ever really worked. So that's another thing that I get angry about with like Elizabeth Warren supporters. But it really just heightens this like class divide that people really need to start focusing on. Liberals really need to start looking at things in terms of like class analysis. You can't understand these greater political narrative problems and contradictions without understanding that fundamentally class interests are at stake. Like, if Joe Biden wins, you get that respectability, decorums, you know, that Obama era quote-unquote normalcy back. But, you know, realistically, if you look at his policies, if you go on his website and look at the things that he, you know, proposes, it's really not too different from Trump. And he's even gone on record recently and saying, and I'll put the article in the show notes here, but he's gone on record saying that this corona epidemic has not changed his mind at all on in terms of a single-payer system. And really, liberals like have to be honest with themselves and realize that when Joe Biden has 60 plus billionaire donors, when he takes power, or if he takes power, you have to consider, who is this man going to be accountable to first? The 60 plus billionaire donors who want to maintain the status quo of insurance premiums and a system run for profit that is, you know, based on information that we're now getting from healthcare professionals and stuff like that, people dealing with this corona epidemic, our healthcare system in the US is fundamentally not set up to take care of everybody in this country. And that has to be blamed in some small part on the profit motive and this entirely convoluted system that we've set up with private insurance. So one thing I want to talk about, and I'll get y'all's feedback on this as well, is the stark contrast of a Biden presidency or a potential Biden presidency versus a Bernie presidency. And I think no greater example in terms of the contrast comes with this idea where Bernie has converted his campaign into focusing on coronavirus relief. He raised millions of dollars for charities, whereas Joe Biden is completely like off the airwaves, like he's gone. And then their excuse was that they spent several days trying to get proper equipment into Joe Biden's house, which we've talked about this before personally, but honestly, I think, you know, they're trying to get like a teleprompter set up in his house because the man can't speak.
No, I think they were trying to get an IV because he just got out of some kind of surgery on his brain that they didn't want us knowing about. I mean,
yeah. Did you see the meme where it was like, it showed like a picture of his head and there was like an incision mark or something? Like, what the fuck is going on with Scarecrow Joe?
What happened was they were trying to get the holographic Joe Biden.
And it just wasn't exactly.
No, I think, you know, with the way that the Democratic, the neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party views ruling and having power is totally different from the way that like Bernie Sanders himself views having power. I think like even with like Elizabeth Warren too, it was interesting because people kept saying that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren were the same. And if you like, they just totally weren't, because if you break down the way that Bernie Sanders views power, he views like himself as sort of empowering the working class. Like he is standing in for the working class. Like he's giving power to the working class. Whereas, you know, the neoliberals think of power as like being given down.
Regulated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so like when you look at Elizabeth Warren's policies, you know, the way that they view justice is that it has to be funneled through the managerial class first. Right. It's not like they're not empowering the working class. It's like they're just maintaining order and maintaining what they feel is just. And it kind of comes through like how they feel in their personal lives. You know, like it's like no wonder that sort of like white Karens were the main demographic for who supported Elizabeth Warren, because they always view themselves as dawdling gifts to the working class. Oh, maybe I'll tip this service person. Oh, I'm a great person. That's basically what Elizabeth Warren wanted to do, was just, you know, like placate the working class, as opposed to like a Bernie Sanders presidency is literally empowering the world. Like his goal was to give, you know, the working class more power.
He wants to be organizer in chief.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, like I completely agree with what you were saying, Ian. I mean, like the field of work that I'm in, which is kind of in that, it kind of grifts with PMC, I guess. But, you know, it's the people around me were just like, how can you not support Warren? You know, she's everything Bernie is, but she's also a woman. And it was like from the beginning, obviously they don't know the extent of my politics, otherwise I might not work there. But, you know, it was like they just couldn't believe that I was standing on this line. I was like, hey, look, Bernie has this legacy of fighting for these things. And, you know, I haven't seen that with Warren, although, you know, I'm not going to minimize. She did do some good stuff, primarily when she initially got elected. But it was all very like what was it through? It was through the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I mean, that in itself just kind of like screams bureaucracy. And so it was no surprise to me, even though they did do some good work, it's no surprise to me that a lot of the people I worked with were so ardently supportive of her, because I feel like they too, and when we do the work that we do, they a lot of times feel like the common people are like stupid or you know, just not as smart as them, and everything can be fixed with a master plan. And it's like, I've seen you people write, you know, hundreds of pages of policies and it sits on a fucking shelf. You know, it's bureaucracy for bureaucracy's sake. And they're just like, oh, well, I'm a wonk and I love this kind of stuff. It's just so horrible, you know, in my view, at least.
I mean, we need less of that in our political system, in my opinion. Like, we need less wonkery. We need more real material justice for people that need it. Like, this is just the opposite of what we need. And the problem with the U.S. media narratives and the U.S. like media machine is that it doesn't give proper education to people. There's no elucidation on things like class. Everything about our current system tries to obfuscate class, like with terms like middle class, which ultimately are meaningless if you understand that class is just a relationship to production. Class isn't about your income. It isn't about whether you have some like rental properties that you're getting residual income off of, and then you make like $70,000+ a year. It's not about what you make. It's your relationship to production. And because we don't have proper political education, we don't have like a media in the interests of the working class, like people are liable to fall prey to these media narratives where they just live in a completely distorted reality compared to myself and you, Jared, and Ian and Nathan. You know what I mean? Like these people,
right.
You have to feel almost pity or sorrow for them sometimes, because if they could just get the right information in front of them, I feel like a lot of these people would not be liberals.
Well, I think a lot of the issue too is, you know, your primary alternative network, like your MSNBC, they too are from a class that, well, they're not affected by this stuff. So the only reason they could have lost the election was because of Russia. It couldn't have been these, you know, years of just absolutely nothing getting done other than, you know, like you said earlier, Ian, austerity.
You get the feeling with like most Democratic campaigns that they'd be completely happy to compromise. Like they're totally cool with just like, if we get half of what we ask for, that'll be okay. You know, it's like universal health care. No, Obamacare expansions. That's perfectly fine. If we can get that, then everything's all right. We're like with Bernie, you get the sensation that it's like what he's asking for is only the start. You know, you want to go beyond that. Like you can tell Bernie himself can tell he's compromising. You know that there's going to be more steps beyond Medicare for All, beyond free college and stuff like that. You know, there's more of a movement behind it.
Well, exactly. It is a movement.
Yeah. I mean, and for a lot of us, like, you know, like it keeps being said, and I think it's worth saying again, like for a lot of us, Bernie Sanders was the compromise. Like Bernie Sanders is much to the right of where I would place myself. So
100%,
you know, the fact that these people are now outraged that I won't even compromise Warren vote for like a Joe Biden, it's like I wasn't going to vote anyway until Bernie Sanders came on the scene. And I wasn't even going to vote for Bernie Sanders again until I saw his policy proposal to make workers sit on the boards of large corporations. Like that was what sold it for me. I was like, okay, that is a real policy.
You get the hint that like he wants something more. Like you can see what he's going for. You know what I mean? There's a little bit of socialist dog whistling in his sort of campaign where it's like, you know, he wants to ask for more and that what he's proposing itself is a compromise, you know, which is just interesting because no other Democrat feels that way. Every other Democrat feels like they're going to propose Medicare for all who want it. But if they get, you know, Obamacare expansion, that's totally okay. You know, we'll settle for that. You know, that's totally okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that I respect most about Bernie, like, you know, myself being a communist, is just that I see within him just this personal devotion to justice. And regardless of his political affiliation, being a social democrat, I really feel strongly that he cares as much about justice as I do, if not more. You know what I mean? And I think that's what I identify with him most with. You know what I mean? But it's just so clear to me based on like his response to Corona, his response to just like everything that's going on right now, that he is the clear front runner. You know what I mean? In terms of policy. And it just baffles me that we live in a country where the media apparatus and all these narratives are at play, where people can't see past the fact that corporations are literally bombarding you with this messaging and they've got you in a trap. You know what I mean? They've got people in a trap where they're thinking that the lesser of two evils is what they should go for. And we were just talking about this before we started rolling, but this idea where you poll voters and they're like, they're only voting because they know that their candidate's going to win. Like they vote because they want to vote for the winner rather than voting because they feel strongly about a candidate's platform. And I think this feeds into something very dangerous, like this never Trumper, this blue no matter who type of like ideology that people operate under. I mean, I'll say it and I'll say it clearly, like grow a fucking spine. If you really think at this point that you should vote blue no matter who, you need to grow a fucking spine.
In addition to this, like this language of, you know, vote blue no matter who, and you know, you were saying, Matt, people are just kind of not totally aware of these things. I mean, most people aren't really political in the United States. You know, I don't think that they're given any kind of apparatus for them to feel like, hey, this is a here's an easy entryway into understanding like the interconnectedness of all these things that are affecting me negatively or positively, like on a day-to-day basis. And on top of that, you know, American politics really is a politics of aesthetics, you know, because there isn't a major policy or structural divide between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. I mean, they vote unanimously on most everything. It's only the sort of fights they choose to have on camera that we really like hear about. And so if you have no, if all of the politics boils down to aesthetics, then you have some people who feel like maybe they're more, I don't know, let's say they grew up in a more cosmopolitan environment or something. They're like, oh, well, I support the Democratic Party maybe because they're like cool or friendlier with the gays versus someone out in rural bumfuck Oklahoma, you know, pulling from a recent show I watched. That's like all they've known is, you know, like God fearing, blah, 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 you know, whatever. And so they associate the Republican Party with that. That is like 60% of Americans who give a fuck about politics. I would say that's how they develop their who they're going to vote for in an election, you know. And there isn't any apparatus, because why would there be, to provide a structural alternative to any of that. It's always been a politics of aesthetics.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting too, because if you talk to, you know, Joe out in bumfuck Montana or whatever, like there is this kernel of understanding, you know, like right. what goes on in the class system. I mean,
yeah.
You know, if you ask them who they're voting for, they're going to say Republican. But if you ask them how they feel about their boss, they're going to call them an asshole. That is one way that we heavily deviate from people like Joe Biden, especially for me. Like, I don't feel like people are as stupid as they do. People do have a grasp on this whole thing. And I think that scares them, too. It scares the political elite that, you know, the working class largely has this unspoken understanding that capitalism is not working, that their boss sucks, that you know, working for a wage sucks, that these things are not good for them. What they don't have, and this is all that the liberals care about, they don't have this abstract language to talk about it. They don't right, have yeah. this kind of, you know, philosophical meandering that like the liberals do to right. kind of get that point across for them. And it's funny because they're actually a lot more Marxist than some Marxists are. It's for them, it's completely material. It's, hey, I need to like have healthcare. I need to be able to provide for my family. And that's all I care about.
Right.
I mean, right. And that's where we can come in. We just have to be able to take advantage of that.
You see it play out in some of the polls. Like, you'll see Republicans who are like in favor of like a universal healthcare system and a bunch of different things like that, where they're actually sort of progressive in a weird way, but they're just not really like, they don't see the Democrats as accessible, you know, as the Republican Party in some cases, or accessible as someone like Trump, you know, who's like extremely populist.
Right. And why? And also, too, you have a Democratic Party that's sort of molded itself now into this politics, because they're not running on anything material. So they're kind of turned into this party of identity politics. And, you know, if you take what's happened recently with the allegations against Joe Biden, very credible, all of a sudden, all these like Me Too, Time's Up, you know, liberal, you know, actors or just liberal Democrats in general, like Kirsten Gillibrand, for instance, you know, they're completely silent on this now. And if you are one of those people who like you were talking about, Ian, who like you do think of the world in a Marxist way, you just don't like necessarily have the language or the maybe political education to put it into that framework. You know, but you see this party that supposedly this party of like that is hailing itself as a party of, we care about all these social, you know, justice issues. But then when the social justice shit comes at us, now we're no longer talking about that. To yeah. an average person, that would seem extraordinarily hypocritical. And then take that person and shift them even further to the Trumpian base. Right. Because now it's almost like validating what Trump has been saying about these people, you know, they're lying about me, whatever. And that's why I've said, I think on the pod before, is like Trump, he lies with like grains of truth. He yeah. says something yeah. and it's obviously like completely bullshit, but there is just a smidgen of truth to it. And so it can plant a seed in those people's, you yeah. know, brains.
The funny thing about that, though, is like Trump knows what the DNC is doing to Bernie. You know what I mean? Like, he said it in a tweet. Like, it's sure is a shame that like the DNC is like foiling Bernie, And Trump has said on multiple occasions that he'd rather face Joe Biden than Bernie. And I mean, that tells you a lot about, you know, where things are. But it just, it speaks to the utter incompetence of the establishment Democrats and how they're willing to just constantly capitulate and reach across the aisle to just give the Republicans and the right wing what they want. And liberals, you really need to understand that this is a ruling class apparatus. These people have class interests that align with each other. Pelosi, Biden, Trump, all millionaires. They have class interests that are fundamentally different from you and I. And it's time that people start recognizing that these people don't have your best interests in mind. And when they show you repeatedly that they're going to drag their heels on a stimulus package for workers, they're going to drag their heels on a rent moratorium, they're going to drag their heels on anything that is not absolutely means-tested, like Kamala Harris type, you know, run a profitable business in a low-income area type means-tested bullshit. And this is the type of stuff that we don't have time for, especially with, like, climate crisis looming. Like, look at the way that the party establishment and even Trump, too, on the Republican side has handled this coronavirus thing. Imagine if we had a climate catastrophe, like, and this will be a reality in the next couple decades, and it's already coming to fruition now. Like, imagine these type of people with their hands on the levers of power in an even worse catastrophe that we cannot go back from beyond this pandemic. Like, because the thing about global warming and the thing about climate change is you literally cannot reverse the type of damage that we're doing. And we're getting to the point where we cannot go back from where we are. So if this crisis is any indication that the establishment, both Republican and Democrat, is completely unequipped and incompetent, I don't know what else we can do to convince you that these parties don't deserve the right to exist anymore.
People are always like, well, what's the alternative to Bernie? You know, are we going to run AOC in 4 years or 8 years? Because everyone knows Biden's going to fucking lose. And to me, the answer is no. Like, as I've made it very clear, like, I don't care if a Democrat running for the Senate comes up to me and says, Jared, I'm a literal communist. Just vote for me. I'm running as a Democrat. I'm not voting for you. Like, because to me, it's so clear that the Democratic establishment, you can't work within them. We've already seen AOC start to shift more towards the center. You know, there isn't really a means for someone truly on the left to attain power within that structure. And so I'm just not willing to deal with it anymore. And that's why the left really needs to start getting organized around how do we build a workers' party? You know, does the DSA become the DSP, the Democratic Socialist Party? If so, how do you bring in a coalition to better bring in like other left groups, arouse the mobilization that Bernie had, but around real fighters, real change, something out of the system itself?
I mean, I think one thing, and I think, you know, this is something the coronavirus has opened up, something that also I think, you know, as much as we don't want to do it, but taking cues from what did work in the Trump campaign, is I think the working class in general, the masses in general, are just looking for someone that's even going to recognize their pain. Like, that's one thing that Trump continues to hold his base on doing, is by saying, look at these Democrats. They don't care about you. Look at what they're doing. I see, you know, I recognize your pain. They're all corrupt. This whole system is corrupt. But look what I'm going to do for you. Even though he doesn't do anything, everyone is in so much pain that just the mere fact that he recognizes all this corruption and like just greed, you know, that is enough. That's almost enough for them, just because they haven't seen someone do that ever in their lives. Like just that posture is enough to keep their base. And that's something that, luckily, I mean, like, one thing that we are really good at on the left is criticizing. Like, we're just just really good contrarians. Yeah. And so I think one thing that we should do is fill in the gap of what Bernie didn't do. And that's essentially tearing down the Democratic Party. Like, we have to get rid of this party. It's terrible.
Yeah, you have to wonder if, like, is the Democratic Party just so tainted that lifelong voters will just never go to it just because of who they are? is there a chance that a third party could be appealing just because they are out there criticizing both Democrats and Republicans? Like, is there a way that we could maybe appeal to the masses outside of the Democratic Party?
I mean, that's the thing, though, is like, I mean, granted, you never know what it is the fuck you see online and whatnot, but it's like, They've done for years, and this is even pre-Bernie. They've interviewed, you know, they've done poll after poll on like Americans and if they would be open to the idea of a third party. And it's always this overwhelming, oh my gosh, yes, we need another party, blah, 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 blah. But yet you never see one materialize when voting comes, and you never see any like sort of political agency get corralled around any other political party. But for the first time, what I'm seeing on social media is so many people who I kind of just regarded as like, you know, maybe just liberals or like, you know, to the left of center liberals who are like Bernie adjacent, but still very much within the confines of like sort of the liberal establishment system, completely just be like, nah, fuck this. Like, I'm not voting. If we're not going to take a stand now, then when are we going to? We've ran this guy two times and they've actively sabotaged him from start to finish.
Yeah.
So what the fuck is the point? Like, why even try? And that to me shows me that I'm not saying we're going to get it figured out in the next 4 years, but my God, we fucking better, because I'm not worried about, you know, I mean, Trump gets elected again. Sure, that sucks, whatever. But I'm worried about what comes after Trump, you know, when you have DeSantis 2024 or some shit.
Oh,
you know?
God.
What do y'all think is like a realistic like expectation in terms of a workers party developing after, you know, whatever ends up happening with Bernie? Because, I mean, obviously, like, I've spent a lot of time, like, I've donated to Bernie. I've been canvassing for him. Like, I really believe in Bernie's movement. But it's just like, we have to be able to like admit that like with the party establishment stacked up against him, he may not win or he may not even come close. So like, what realistically can we do to like start organizing a real workers' party with the same type of donor base as Bernie's movement? Like, how do we get these people into a class conscious, like, socialist movement that has real demands?
I think having, you know, an actual minimum program is really important. That's something they stressed in Social Subcurrent Alternative that I think they were always right about, was, listen, you have to have sort of a minimum program, a transitional program that is able to capture the immediate needs of the working class. And that coupled with, you know, I think we do have to take a more polemical position towards the Democratic Party. Like, you know, obviously the Republican Party is full of complete ghouls, but they're going to exist. Like, the U.S. needs a far right party because it's a far right country, you know, for like just structurally and fundamentally. But, you know, we have to replace the Democratic Party as the left party, because of first past the post polling. I feel like I've kind of come to, you know, a conclusion that you really can't win like as a third party candidate, but what you can do is get rid of the Democratic Party and out of sort of the, you know, emergent ashes of that whole thing crumbling down, build a real working class party, a real labor party.
The one thing I know you and I have talked about before, Ian, like just over Facebook messages, is like, hey, do you support socialized medicine, Medicare for all? Yes. Okay. Do you support like a Green New Deal? Yes. Okay. Do you support this, that, or the other? They all agree. It's not until you start cracking into the weeds do you get this just insane, like, you know, like narcissism of small differences between all these different left groups and all these different left orgs. And we need to emerge clearly with kind of like this united front, like this united line of like, look, kind of like what DSA has. They have these like 10 principles that they stand for. Say, okay, we're all going to get behind this. And then, look, if you MLs or you anarchists or whatever, you guys want to hash it out, go get drinks afterwards and, you know, fucking throw beer bottles at one another. But like, when we're here doing political work, we need to be unified behind this message and do exactly what you said. You know, throwing, you know, Molotov cocktails at the, figuratively for parody, at the Democratic Party establishment, say, hey, like, we're not going to play this fucking game anymore. And, you know, also too, we really, as cringy as the term has become online, you know, we need kind of this party of the dirtbag left, you know, one that is willing to completely part ways with this just, you know, bullshit neoliberal, like, appeals to, you know, Twitter wokeness, and is completely in line with a class-based program from start to finish.
100%. And I think, you know, I think a lot of that woke Twitter culture too is an emergent aspect of neoliberal, because what it is, it's just sort of cultural means testing. You know, it's like, okay, you are using the correct language and you have the right opinions on this certain group. So now you can have healthcare, and now you can have it. You can have your college, and you can have, you know, food on the table. But you say you make a problematic joke or whatever. No. You deserve your poverty. And I think without, you know, giving into what, like, liberals would love, which is to be overtly, quote unquote, class reductionist, you know, we do have to say, no. Whether or not you understand, like, things at a woke level, you still do not deserve to live in poverty.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that, like, neoliberalism, like, fights against. Correct me if I'm wrong, if someone knows, but I think it was Pinochet that said something about, like, this idea that Marx has come up with, like, things like human rights being, like, a very savvy invention. But I really do honestly feel like there should be such things as human rights. Obviously, like, it's just immoral and unethical to be, like, having someone go into bankruptcy to fight their cancer with chemo treatments. Like, right. How do you allow that to exist? Or how do you allow a system to exist where, like, fundamentally, at a fundamental core level, you're not guaranteeing these, like, healthcare or the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to people? Like, these things, I think, in my opinion, are compatible with, like, just America, like, and right. our values as, like, working class people in America. But it's just, people need to redirect their anger. Like, we've seen crazy shit happening since this corona outbreak, like anti-Chinese racism and all of this stuff. It's like, people need to understand that there are clear levers of power. There are clear class relationships. Yeah. And it's not about the individual, like, identity politics and all of this stuff. Like, we know the people that are killing the planet. We know these people. They have names. They have addresses. Like, this is very much a class-oriented structural problem. And if you're only going to look at things from an aesthetic or identity-based point of view, then you're never going to have your thumb on where the arc of justice is.
Right. And it's like, I've said it 100 million times. I'll say it till my turn blue in the face. Doesn't matter if tomorrow Amazon taken over by a trans woman of color, Amazon's still going to be sending their fucking workers to work with COVID-19. You know?
Because the board of directors, like, they want profit. Capitalism has certain drives. Why would the identity of the CEO change the capital drives of a corporation? It just it's not feasible. And part of this, like, this harebrained bullshit ideology that neoliberalism imparts onto our culture is these false political ideas of representation and justice. And that's just not where justice comes from. Justice comes from equality and equity and equal distribution or equitable distribution of commodities and necessities. Like, it's always been that way, and it'll always be that way.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, you see sort of your rationale, the incoherence of representational politics in, like, just Hillary Clinton's stint as, you know, Secretary of Defense, because, I mean, did she care about women of color when she was bombing them in the Middle East? Like, she didn't. So, you know, there is sort of a dead end of representational politics, whereas it only extends to a certain group of whatever demographic you're talking about, which tends to be, like, the rich who exist in that demographic.
So, yeah, definitely. But, you know, we talked about it earlier, but I think we should just kind of get into it at this point. You know, with the coronavirus, everyone listening to this, you're probably dealing with quarantine. You're probably dealing with toilet paper and paper towel shortages in the grocery store. And it's, you know, very important that people understand what is actually going on with the economy and the stock market. But more so, rather than like anything else, I think it's important from this crisis to understand that because like the gig economy, the service sector, the restaurant industry is primarily hit hardest by this type of stuff because people can't go out. There's low demand. There's tons of supply, but low demand. So you're getting layoffs and all that stuff. It's important for people to understand that like the stock market is tanking because people can't work. People can't labor. And what that really highlights is that labor is producing the value in the economy. The CEOs, Jeff Bezos, the quote-unquote job creators, these people would not have the wealth that they have if they weren't extracting it day by day from people who are just trying to meet their needs of survival. Like you've got someone working for $11 an hour in a warehouse or $15 an hour in a warehouse. These people are trying to meet their needs of survival. And it's no longer about like whether, you know, you're sad that you can't go to a concert or you're sad that you can't. What this is highlighting is that labor is creating the value in our economy. And I think that in a lot of ways has gone to show people that this libertarian free market ideology, not only is it complete bullshit, but the free market has never really existed, especially in the U.S. We've always had capitalism propped up by a bourgeois state, which has a class character that is in the interests of the bourgeois class or the ruling class. And it's time that people start recognizing them.
I absolutely agree. I think, you know, yeah, this is, I really love how the coronavirus has, you know, highlighted the mythology of the free market, because when you do look at sort of the initial decline of the stock market in probably late February into mid March, you know, it was sinking. It was across the board was just sinking. And then out of nowhere, you see the federal government come in and start slashing interest rates and setting up these, you know, money mills, and just allowing corporations to draw, you know, as pretty much as much money as they wanted. And then all of a sudden, now you start seeing stocks rising. And, you know, everyone in the sort of financial media world was saying, oh, wow, look, you know, having a great, the Dow is up, you know, 800 points or whatever. And it's like, right. But if you did have a real free market, right, then like they would still be plummeting because the rationality of the market would have these companies go under. But you can't have that, because if we did have an actual free market, capitalism would collapse in a fucking a year.
Well, and that's another thing, too, is, you know, yeah, we've seen the stocks start to go up only because the federal government is, yeah, slashing interest rates, pumping trillions of dollars into the economy artificially to try and get, you know, investors happy again and willing to put their money back in the stock market, yada, yada, yada. But again, they're putting trillions of dollars into this, and I don't see any Americans going back to work. I don't see people going out, you know, to the grocery store. Well, they still are going to the grocery stores. It's a bad example, but they're not, you know, consuming in their normal ways. But at the end of the day, what I'm getting at is this is not sustainable. Like the stock market might be going up now because they're pumping a bunch of money into it. But if laborers can't labor and in turn they don't have the money then from the labor that they're engaging in to go and contribute to the economy, then it's only going to go up so long before it drops off again. That's just the reality of it.
Yeah, and I think the class character of the state, even if it could continue to prop up capitalism on quantitative easing and sort of, you know, modern monetary based economics, I don't even think politically it could, because that would sort of destroy the whole, you know, narrative that, you know, we can't fund these social programs, right? We can't have Medicare for all because we can't fund it. When, I mean, we're starting to kind of see that that's, we've always known it's bullshit, but we're starting to see even more now that that's bullshit. So I think even if economically, right, they could continue to prop up the market for, you know, who knows how long with just the, you know, printing money, I don't even think politically they could do it, because that would just lay everything to bear and that would ruin them.
money printer go brrr. Right.
I think one thing that's pretty like startling about this whole situation was that we saw Republicans coming out and making more sort of like economic populist appeals than Democrats. Like not so much now, but especially when it first started, you had people like Rick Scott, the senator of Florida, Republican, coming out and saying like, hey, the bailouts that we do, they need to be focused on the people, not on the businesses. Even the people coming out originally in favor of like this sort of like UBI-esque like stimulus package where they're going to send money to people was mostly popular with Republicans first, which is sort of like startling in a way where it's like, have the Democrats been outflanked by the Republicans in terms of like economic populism? Like how can we let that happen?
Right. Well, because originally the, you know, Chuck Schumers and all that shit were like, oh, well, maybe the Democrat alternative can be micro loans. You know what I mean? Or whatever that shit that libs were obsessed with, that the Grameen Tax Bank credit. And whatnot. It was just absolutely absurd. And I mean, obviously, they all came around. And then who you mentioned, like Rick Scott from, you know, the great state of Florida, he is now coming under fire because all of the people in Florida who are trying to get unemployment, and it's an absolutely abysmal nightmare to get through because they intentionally gutted the system because they didn't want people to be getting as much unemployment because they, you know, typical right wing bullshit narrative that they themselves don't even believe in, but regurgitate that, well, if you give someone a check for too long, then they're just never going to go back to work.
I mean, we knew it was just a front. We knew they weren't like actually in favor of working class policies, right. But at the same time, it's sort of scary because can we bet that the average person knew the difference? You know, I don't think we reliably can. And so that's scary because it's like, how many voters are they going to win over just because they acted first, you know, just because they have the initiative?
Yeah. And then on top of that, you have them doubling down now with their anti-Medicare for all stances, you know, like they're actively going on television to say, no, we're still like against Medicare for all in this pandemic, even though, you know, we have virtually not enough hospital beds because the hospitals didn't find them profitable. So they didn't buy extra because they wanted to have more money for their shareholders. We don't have enough ventilators because of the same reason. And the list just goes on and on and on. It's like all the contradictions of capitalism are heightening to a point where people are finally starting to say, holy shit, what is going on? And I never in my fucking life thought it would be because of a pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, you have an unemployment that they're rumoring could be approaching 30% at the peak of this crisis. And you have to wonder, like, if all their health care is tied to their employment, you're going to have 30% of the population realizing, wow, this is a really fucking stupid idea. The idea that we get insurance through our employer, and if you don't, then it's unreasonably expensive or shitty coverage. Like, people are going to start waking up to that pretty quick.
Yeah, this is like the compounding of class politics that you see, because quite honestly, like, and, you know, I'll eat my hat if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of those 30% of those people are gig workers, like gig economy, service sector, restaurant sector employees. And most of them are probably Bernie supporters already. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's not the crises that are happening to these PMC Biden supporters. It's the crises that are happening to the working class. And that's why people need to really understand that this is the field that we're faced with. It is working class versus ruling class, and that's the way it is. That's the way society under industrial capitalism has always been.
Yeah, and it's because, like, I just saw this headline the other day that said that, you know, support for Medicare for All shot up ever since the coronavirus happened. And, you know, it kind of does give credence to the kind of whack job leftist article that was going around a couple years ago, the disaster communism, and that sort of, like, the perfect storm, which is kind of happening, which is, you know, the economy is already inflated and that was already, you know, prone for a recession, is going to be compounded by some kind of either, you know, environmental disaster or pandemic or something, you know, that was going to kind of have the wheels fall off. And, you know, I think as this draws on, as people become closer and closer to real poverty, you know, I think they're going to start realizing that there's something messed up in the system. This isn't just kind of like a Democratic versus Republican issue. It's more structural than that.
There seems to be a sort of flat line in terms of like the stock market recovery. Like, honestly, looking at the stock market today and for the last week, it's been pretty consistent. But what's strange is this is the week where they announced that possibly 10 million people are going to be on unemployment this week. So I think you can clearly see the difference between like what the theoretical stock market economy is versus like the actual working class, like, hey, how are we doing as a society sort of economy? You know, there's a clear line between those things. And one can only hope, you know, I'm sure as we all do, that hopefully people wake up to that and realize like, hey, maybe when the upper class is doing so well for themselves and they're quote unquote recovered and we're not, maybe that's sort of like, you know, emblematic of how the system works in general.
Right. And to me too, it's like, where are the motherfucking libertarians right now? I don't see a single motherfucker against this $1,200 a month check. Seriously, right? Because I mean, who would be, you know, logically, unless they're insulated by the whole crisis. But one thing that could, I will say, make me go like full, like just doomer nihilist is if this shit recovers, say a year from now, and it's like everything still pretty much fucking sucks, and still no one, like no one in the United States does anything fundamentally to change it, you know, so that that doesn't happen again. Because I kind of see how 2008 happened, you know what I mean? Like people didn't immediately kind of catch on to what was happening. I mean, you did sort of have a reaction to it, which was Occupy Wall Street, but obviously that was disjointed, wasn't super unified. Now we kind of have unified as the left. I mean, not totally, but we have had someone with a major platform talking about, you know, Medicare for all, or even in Andrew Yang's case, a UBI. And we were kind of told all these things were absolutely insane and could never happen. And yet in the face of crisis, they are, you know, everyone hates socialism until it's required to bail out the system. And so to me, if something doesn't change after this, I don't know what the fuck it would take at that point.
I mean, that's kind of the point of our show here, is so they can recognize who is actually like fucking them, you know? And it's just, it's high time that people start to realize that class politics are not a conspiracy. Like this idea that the ruling class has an agenda and a narrative is not a conspiracy. And I think it was Parenti that had a lecture, and he said one time, when school bus drivers and nurses organize for better wages and better working conditions, no one bats an eye. But when the rich people do it, like Bezos and Gates and Warren Buffett and the Koch brothers do it, everybody thinks you're a conspiracy theorist when you say that the rich all have interests that are aligned, and those interests include absolutely bludgeoning and subjugating the working class.
Right.
So it's like ridiculous that people still think that these things like free markets exist and that these things are voluntary exchanges. Like at this point, if you see a friggin' grocery store employee with no personal protective equipment working for $9 an hour, getting in contact with hundreds of people on a daily basis amid this pandemic, come and fucking tell me that this is a voluntary exchange. I'll wait. Right.
Yeah, support our troops, our real troops, the ones in Publix and all that shit. But I mean, no, actually, that's another thing, though, is like, you know, at the end of the day, in many ways, the system that was is sort of still chugging along. I mean, in the face of this crisis, we have the talk of the United States economy, you know, completely falling out and all these people being unemployed. What system is still actively afloat abroad in virtually every country across the world? The United States military, right? It's still operating. We have sanctions still being placed on Venezuela, Iran, Russia, North Korea, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we have the United States or FBI or CIA, I don't remember which one of those fucking ghoulish entities it was, just unleashing havoc on Venezuela over trumped up drug charges or whatever the case may be, you know, just going, still actively engaging in military affairs, and which is all coming from taxpayer dollars and, you know, the economy itself. Hence why one of the first people that they were concerned with bailing out was Boeing. It just shows that even in the face of extreme crisis, this system very much finds a way to keep the power structure in place and very effectively so.
Yeah, and they're bailing out cruise ship lines and just absolute unessential bullshit that they're bailing out. And this whole Venezuelan anti-drug operation was totally a move by the Trump administration to distract from the coronavirus crisis at home. And even like Newsweek had an article about it, and I'll post it in the show notes. But it's really just so transparent at this point, all the type of like misdirection. It's really like the managers of capital, like to be a good manager of capital at this point, you really have to be like a David Blaine type, like a sleight of hand type of person, where you just get people to like believe in these like bullshit little breadcrumb stories about Maduro being a drug trafficker and all that stuff. And never mind the fact that we denied like shipments of like medical like equipment and supplies to them amid the coronavirus. Never mind that Iran is like run away with fucking immense amounts of like coronavirus deaths and cases. But these countries are suffering because of U.S. sanctions right now. And not only is it unethical to maintain these sanctions, especially during this crisis, but it's really just like it is an example of just the profound cruelty of the U.S. state. And just it's sickening that even Russia is sending the U.S. Supplies and equipment. And it's sickening that we can't raise these sanctions to make sure people are cared for. It's like we have no solidarity as a species that we allow this to happen.
Right.
And it's sickening.
Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, like people still eat it up, because it's like I shared some article about how, you know, the U.S. was doing some bogus shit in Venezuela. And one of my friends messaged me and was like, OK, but what if it's true? It's still wrong. And it's like, first of all, how am I even supposed to take any of it, you know, to be in any way truthful, when I watched one of the major political parties of this country pull what, if it had been done in Venezuela, they would have unleashed a full-scale CIA operation to topple the government. In addition to that, even if it is true, it's like, what would you, I mean, do you blame them for trying to get some new form of lucrative capital when you have stripped them of all of their resources and have it in some bank account on hold that only fucking, what's his name, Juan Guaido has access to, along with any of your CIA counterparts? Like, it's just absurdity. Like, the just general, like you said, Matt, just general, genuine cruelty that the U.S. is willing to like engage in at a time like this. It's just, it's amazing, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's because the U.S. state doesn't really deal in, you know, morality. It's never been about doing what's right for people of Venezuela. I mean, it's about maintaining power and hegemony, you know, across the world. I mean, and that's sort of like the undercurrent of what sanctions are. It's like, you know, you starve the people of a certain country enough so that, you know, they blame their own
government
and overthrow it and allow the U.S. to come swoop in and start giving out food. And then it becomes, now we're heroes.
Yeah, like, IMF loans, structural adjustment policies, all that.
Yeah, exactly. If you don't see that as just inherently like cruel and you know.
Violence. It's violence.
Yeah, literally violence. I would say it's even, honestly, in a sense, like worse than just going in there with boots on the ground. I mean, and like I have this debate with my roommate sometimes, because he thinks that you know, economic sanctions are like a more progressive form of foreign policy. Like, I would much rather just get fucking bombed and starved to death, honestly.
Yeah, it's like inhumane, you know. At least with the, you know, that there's some type of a conflict, but with, you know, the sanctions, it's just like you're starving people. Like, imagine, put yourself in the shoes of like Iraqis who, or Yemenis who, like the Saudis have bombed like 43 plus water treatment plants amid this crisis. And it's just, it's absolutely cruel. You know, supplying them arms and munitions, and like, it's, we live in a hell world. There's which way about it. It's a hell world that we live
in. I mean, Yemen, what's going on in Yemen right now, it like a literal Holocaust. I mean, there's just like,
yeah,
it's just a fact, you know. Yeah. It's just, we're not thinking of it in the same context because it's over there. We're not seeing it on a day-to-day basis. It's another one of those countries that we just associate with being in complete political and economic and militaristic turmoil. But It's a literal fucking Holocaust. And I mean, you raised a really good point, Ian, that we actually touched on one of our earlier episodes. And you said, you know, on our episode, when we were talking about socialism versus capitalism. And what you said was, you know, this system doesn't think in terms of morals. And you're absolutely right. It's like, it's about maintaining a particular structure of power with the intent to have dominance on capital and resources globally, because ultimately that is where political power is driven from, is the material. And that's exactly why the system is continuing to operate in the way it is. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, good or bad or evil or, you know, whatever, any which way in between. It's just about upholding that level of power.
And this is why the stock market doesn't react to death toll, right? Because it doesn't really care how many people die. It just, you know, it just cares if production can continue, people can still have access to the commodities that these corporations are offering.
I think that's a good takeaway. Like, people need to recognize that the Trump administration has talked about, like, sacrificing grandma so the line can go up, you know, and it's utter cruelty. It's cruelty. And it's like, it's so irrational, and it's literally death panels. You know, it's deciding who dies and who doesn't. And I've even faced it at my job and my work. Like, I've had, you know, this past few weeks that we got on a conference call, and the owners of the company basically said, okay, stay home for these next 2 weeks. And then literally, like, this past week, like, a few days in, they were trying to get me to go back on site and do, like, on-site projects for our clients. And I work in IT, and, you know, I work in dental offices a lot too. So it's like, those are not the places that you want to be in when you know that the coronavirus can live up to, like, what is it, 24 hours in the air. And it's just like, these people don't give a flying fuck about our health. Like, bosses and CEOs and capitalists, they don't care. They do not care about human life, and they will do anything that they can to extract the resources that we produce and the wealth that we produce. But you guys need to hear it here first. Labor is prior to and independent of capital, and labor runs the economy. That's why the stock market is crashing, because people can't work. It's not the CEOs and quote-unquote job creators that are giving the economy life. It's the literal people that bag your groceries. It's the people that mop the floors, the people that serve you when you go out to a restaurant. These are the people that make the economy run, not the CEOs. All right, so last section is actually a listener question. This question comes from Allie, who is a subscriber on our Patreon. So we want to, first of all, thank Allie for listening. We had an episode not too long ago about police unions with my friend Kelsey Duggan on, and we're very appreciative of the time she spent with us. But the question that Allie posed to us would be, what would community policing look like in a more equitable, judicial, socialist society? And my first thought kind of goes to, like, the Black Panther movement in the 60s and 70s and community, like, patrols and things like that. But I'm going to open it up to the group. What do y'all think about what policing would look like under a socialist society?
So, yeah, I think, you know, we have to kind of divorce our, you know, what a socialist kind of you know, community safety patrol would be from the way the modern, you know, the police force in its entire history has operated. The police force has always been, you know, to protect, you know, those who own property. It's always existed that way. Only recently has this protect and serve idea, you know, been thrown out into the public. But, you know, I think less of a desire to punish people who sort of break a social norm, and more of a desire to kind of have a justice that's restorative, you know, like that is mainly made to protect people and have their safety in mind. So I also think there's something I've always said, like, when this conversation comes up, which is, like, there would be a lot less need for this kind of thing in a socialist society, because there wouldn't be crime out of desperation.
which is like where a lot of crime comes from. So, you know, we'd see a lot of scaling back of the need to patrol areas and communities and stuff like that, you know, and just have some kind of community night watch kind of thing.
Yeah, just like, you know, call on your neighbor, depend on your neighbors and your community rather than police or bureaucracy that is really oriented towards protecting capital and capital interests and property. I mean, we've had several episodes. Like, we had our police union episode previously, but then we had another episode, like an older episode, about the institution of policing in general. And like Ian said, like, from the outset, it's always been about protecting capital interests and property. And this protect and serve idea is relatively new.
Yeah. So, I mean, I largely agree with what you were talking about, Ian, that, and you as well, Matt. I think the reality is we so regularly overlook how much, quote unquote, like, deviant behavior, what we consider deviant behavior, is related to lack of access to resources, right? Communities that typically have very low funded education systems, for instance, tend to be high crime areas, right? Why? Because you don't have a strong social safety net there to educate, reinforce, sort of look after the kids of that community and so forth. You also have an entire system predicated on, let's say, like, property taxes or what have you. In addition, when you take at drug addiction or drug use or drug abuse, it typically comes from moments of extreme desperation. I have no one else. I have nothing else to go to. You know, how do I take this pain away? There's no mental health care system. There's no, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Why do people steal? They don't have access to things. Why don't they have access to things? Because maybe their parents don't have a job or the, whoever, you know, in their immediate circle. And so I think if you can develop a system that largely addresses those needs, which are always first and foremost material needs, you know, the role of policing as we understand it, I think, largely becomes obsolete. I don't think that any notion of it is completely gone and done away with. I mean, like you were saying, there could still be like domestic assault. There's other things that people can have that they do certain behaviors that are, I think, beyond, let's say, the scope of just capitalism or material relations. But I think, you know, some kind of community network or just, you know, heavily democratic structure, I think, could enforce that a lot better than a militarized and entrenched police force that's sole purpose is to maintain current class relations.
I think you guys all nailed it pretty well. It's just like, we need to have a sort of like radical democracy inside of policing itself. We need to be paying attention to like what laws are actually important. Do we need to be enforcing drug laws? You know, even on like a local level, we've seen that you can have an impact just by like decriminalizing weed, you know, and doing things like that, that can have a pretty, even in within our current system, can have a pretty drastic impact on the type of people that are going to jail or the type of crimes that are being committed or being punished, rather.
I mean, you see the parallels, and like, we've done an episode on uneven development, and we've talked heavily about gentrification and the mechanics of gentrification. But the way I see it is, like, in my opinion, like, if we were to take away a lot of the problems that cause crimes out of desperation, we would remove the need for a lot of policing entirely. And that's the way I look at things. And that's the way that, like, I would hope to structure a society to where you would have democratic ownership over like police forces in a given area. I still think that there is a relative amount of bureaucracy that's necessary to enforce things.
Yeah.
I would just include a democratic element to it. And like we talked about in our previous episode with police unions, oftentimes police unions are organizing so that the police themselves get off scot-free from any type of accountability. And like, I think my vision for what a socialist system would include would just be a very highly democratic, accountable police force in general at the core. So with that said, we want to thank everyone for listening to the Entry Level Left and our bonus episode. Ian, is there anything you want to plug? Any music or any personal projects that you're working on? Twitter that people can follow you on? Anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, you could follow me on Instagram if you want. It's Hinton Music. Yeah, if you need an audio engineer for anything, hit me up, because that's what I do when I'm not doing politics. So, yeah. Sure, thanks for having me on, guys. Like, I really appreciate it. Super fun. I never get to talk about this stuff except for online. So yeah, it was really cool. I had a lot of fun, and I hope I can come back another time.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. Sure. We'd love that. So, yeah, without further ado, guys, if you want to find us online, we have a link tree. If you go to our Facebook page at Entry Level Left and also on Twitter at Entry Level Left, you can find our link tree. If you go there, you can find links to our PayPal if you want to do a one-time donation, if you want to subscribe to our Patreon and get access to the future exclusive bonus content that we'll do, consider going to our Patreon and subscribing there. Also, if you click on our link tree from our Facebook page, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, everything. Anything that that we're on, you can find it there. If there's a platform that we're not on that you'd like us on, reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter or whatever and send us a message, and we'll try to get our podcast distributed there as well. We hope that you tune in next time, and stay safe from that corona, guys. We'll be right back.